This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
This
is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, from household robots to virtual reality, why yesterday's next big things are making a comeback.
We live in an age of unprecedented technological achievements, scientific adventures whose full benefits to mankind cannot as yet be fully foreseen. Yet man's greatest adventure may be more than a monumental landing on the moon. It may well be the ever-increasing acquisition of techniques and knowledge. Technology that can make the quality of life for all mankind richer and more bountiful.
Richer and more bountiful. Well, maybe more like busier and faster. They call it vaporware. Those fabulous technological innovations that promise so much, but are always just around the corner, never to materialize. But today, we're looking at technological marvels that have long been promised that are about to see the light of day. No, really.
Let me see. What would I print if I had a 3D printer? Why, I would print a replica of myself, maybe even two. I am a stay-at-home mom with two school-age children and a 16-month-old. Having two or more of myself would be really great. I would no longer have to choose what to do, dinner, sleep, laundry, or clean. I would simply gather up my other selves and say, you, do the laundry. Light, medium, dark. Check my husband's pants for pens. You make chicken Kiev, mashed potatoes, and asparagus, and I will take a nap with my darling baby girl. Nothing like dreaming the day away. This is Jennifer Adamson in Toronto.
To start, remember the replicator from Star Trek The Next Generation?
Tea Earl Grey hot.
This little wonder gizmo could make virtually any object as long as you knew the molecular structure.
I'm Adrian Bowyer. I'm a senior lecturer in the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Bath in the UK.
Imagine if you could make objects in your own home just by printing them out, like with a computer printer, but 3D. Well, guess what? It turns out you can. So, Adrian, how does the 3D printer work?
Imagine a glue gun, mm-hmm. and imagine a flat sheet of wood, and imagine you were to draw a shape on the flat sheet of wood with a glue gun and fill it in. Mm-hmm. And then you lift the glue gun up a little bit and draw another slightly different shape on top of the one that you've just drawn. And you keep doing that. Eventually, you build up a three-dimensional pile of glue. And all you do is you replace the glue gun with a rather finer nozzle. Mm-hmm. And you put in a plastic other than the glue they put in the glue gun, which is more rigid when it sets. And you then can build up three-dimensional plastic objects under the control of a computer from a direct description of them inside the computer without any other human intervention.
Fantastic. You know, we've been hearing about the 3D printer really for decades. Why is this finally seeming like it's becoming a reality?
Well, I think that the reason for the delay is patent law. All the technologies were invented, as I say, 20 or 30 years ago. But the patents are now coming to an end. And so that situation is going to change very quickly and very radically, I think.
So what kinds of things can you make with this?
The first generation of our machine will make any plastic object within a working volume of about a 300-millimeter cube. That's a foot cube. Mm-hmm. And typical sorts of things you might make are coat hooks or, you know, cat flaps for the cat going out of the door or a comb.
And the idea, as these 3D printers are implemented, would be basically that you would, I guess, get the blueprints or the plans for the object that you wanted to print from online or whatever, and then print it up in your house. Is that right?
Yes. The file format that they use is very, very straightforward. And there's nothing to stop you designing an object and putting it up on the web and then having 25 cents drop into your account every time someone downloads it, or you might choose to give it away free, mm-hmm. Rather in the same way that music downloads work now, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've posted the plans for the printer online, so anyone can get access to it and improve the plan. It's sort of an open source 3D printer. Why did
Absolutely.
You choose to do that?
Well, two reasons. Not only are the plans available online, but the printer is capable of printing almost all its own component parts, which means that if you've got one, you can print one out and give it to a friend. Now, you've got a bit of a difficulty if you've got a machine that can reproduce, uh-huh. in that it's very difficult not to give it away.
a little bit of a business model problem there. Other than the sheer coolness of being able to print objects, what do you think the biggest implications of this technology are?
Well, it replaces a lot of things in what people in suits tend to call the supply chain. If you imagine how you get a comb sitting on your dressing table at home, first of all, somebody has to set up an oil well and they have to take the oil, and then somebody has to set up a chemical plant and they have to take the oil and turn it into plastic, and then somebody has to take that plastic and take it to a hairbrush or a comb plant, and then you have to drive to the shop and buy your hairbrush or a comb and take it home. Mm-hmm. And that is a long and complicated process. Now, we're still going to need the plastic, of course, but all the other parts of the supply chain can be eliminated if people can download the design for a comb from the web and then print it out and have it available to them half an hour later.
Hmm. Completely fascinating, Adrian. But once we all get 3D printers in our homes, can I ask you, can you get to work on perfecting the paper printer? Because that doesn't seem to work very well.
All right. One of the interesting things with technology is that all the little wrinkles and difficulties with it suddenly become more and more obvious and more irritating. The better and better the primary aspect of the technology becomes.
Adrian, thanks so much for talking to us.
That's okay. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, you heard him. The plans for the 3D printer are online. Want to print out your own cat door? We'll post a link to Adrian's RepRap 3D printer, and you can find my full interview with Adrian at our blog. Now, I asked him about the computer printer, because what could be more infuriating than those paper printers? My printer at home is constantly getting jammed. It's unbelievable. And look at this piece of junk. PC load letter? What does PC load letter mean? What kind of an error message is that? Ugh! The stupid printer generates more waste paper than anything. Oh, but wait. No wonder they never made printers that worked well. Because we were supposed to be using less and less paper. We were supposed to have the paperless office. Hear that? And that. Yep, paper. And printed on this sheet of paper is an article from Business Week magazine, from June 1975. It's called The Paths to the Paperless Office. It says that the pioneers of the office of the future will have hooked together word processing equipment into office systems to transform information electronically and to move it into and out of central electronic files. For them, it will be the start of the paperless office. Well, it's been a couple of decades now, and we've got the word processors, we've got the electronic office systems. So will we ever get to the truly paperless office?
Well, I think looking back over 20 years, I think the lesson is no, but we should still be positive. I think we realized that then we placed too much emphasis on the process of what we did in offices and workplaces, and not enough emphasis on the purpose of that work. And now we've got the technology to let us do the production, but paper is still the best technology for the finished product, I think.
Hmm. That's Richard Harper. He's a senior researcher at Microsoft, and he's co-author of a book called The Myth of the Paperless Office. And in Canada, at least, it certainly seems to be a myth. We're not decreasing our paper use. In fact, it's going in the opposite direction. In Canada, between 1983 and 2003, our per capita consumption of paper almost doubled. We're now at about 20,000 pages per person. Why are we actually using more paper now, though?
What we do is we spend more time producing the written word than ever. Mm-hmm. And one consequence of that is that we do use more paper than ever. I think also it has to be said that but now, in Microsoft, for example, we receive on average about 100 emails a day per capita per person. The way we do our work's changed, and we seem to spend too much time communicating, I think, and that reflects in how much paper we produce.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things that paper is particularly good at?
When you're preparing a report, quite often you move back and forth, you put one page next beside another page, and then you flick back quickly, and then you put a pencil on a bit, and then you mark another bit. So you kind of use your hands as well as your eyes and your mind to get to grips with the argument in the documents in a kind of three-dimensional form,
mm-hmm.
whereas the digital doesn't let you do that. I don't think in the research world where I work that we any longer believe that the paperless office is where we really want to go. What we think now is that you need digital means to enable you to get to information, and you need paper means to help you comprehend that information once you've got it. So what excites us is not getting rid of paper, but trying to figure out where digital technologies are best and where paper technologies are best. And the future will be offices which have both. So it's early in the 70s and 80s and through the 90s, getting rid of paper became an easy way of saying, make yourself more efficient, change your practices. Change your practices by getting rid of paper. But then I think by the end of the 90s, people realized that they'd gone a little bit too far and got rid of the good things as well as the bad things, the good things that paper can do for you.
Right. Richard, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You can hear more from Richard at our blog. We've posted the full interview of that conversation to cbc.ca/spark, where you'll also find a link to where you can purchase printed transcripts of this program. Just joking. Even technologies that we take for granted today seemed like magic when they first arrived. That same Business Week article I mentioned, the one from 1975, it also talks about a fabulous new innovation that was going to change computing. The user moves a handheld movable controller called a mouse over the desktop.
And in response,
an electronic pointer moves the screen to the word or paragraph to be changed.
Move the mouse left on the screen and hit a button called cut, and the word or paragraph disappears.
Because we use them almost every day, it's easy to take things like the computer mouse for granted. But what if you can't use a mouse?
Hi, I'm Jeff Bilmes. I'm a professor at the University of Washington, Seattle, and I'm the principal investigator of the Vocal Joystick Project.
The vocal joystick is a piece of software designed for people with motor impairments, like people born without the use of their limbs.
Or people who have had injuries, for example, in car accidents, or maybe they've had spinal injuries. Or it's also meant for individuals who have been had injuries in wartime or something, soldiers coming back from Iraq.
And what the software does is allow these people to use their voices to control a mouse cursor on a computer screen. And that's not a particularly new idea. Voice recognition software has been around for a while now.
Move mouse left. Much faster. Very fast. Up.
But it can be clunky.
Slower.
You have to speak individual commands every time you want to move the mouse,
but,
or change direction, or click.
Mouse click.
And you're restricted to moving in straight lines. Up, down, left, right.
Move mouse right.
Kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch.
Much faster.
And that's how Jeff's vocal joystick is different.
So it really is possible to do things like draw a curve. Imagine, for example, using your voice to draw a perfect circle. You can't speak and say, up, 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 left, 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 move left, move right, move down, and so on and so forth. With a vocal joystick, you can actually use vowels and change vowels slowly to actually make a curve.
So browsing a website might sound like this. It sounds pretty strange altogether, but when you break it down into its component parts, it makes sense. For example, if you wanted to move up,
you would say ah, as in the word cat. If you wanted to move down, you would say oo, as in the word boot. Or left, you'd say e, as in the word feet. And ah, as in the word, say, law. And let's say that you wanted to move up for a while and then slowly move over to the right. You would start with ah and then move over to ah. So it would be like ah. And you would slowly, depending on how slow or how quickly you move it, it would determine how quickly the curve would move over to the right as you're starting from moving up.
And to click the mouse?
So you would just say k or ch.
And why is this something that you wanted to tackle?
And one reason is that it really does give individuals with motor impairments the ability to use computers more easily. And I think that's an important thing because many of these folks are people who have perfect use of their voice and would be able to do very productive work in society. And a couple of examples are things, for example, like photo restoration. And that's becoming more and more ubiquitous of an application for which if you didn't have the use of a mouse, you wouldn't be able to do. And now with a vocal joystick, you'd be able to do that job. And that's actually a pretty high-paying job these days. People were willing to pay a lot of money to hire people to do that sort of thing. Now individuals with motor impairments who don't have hands or arms can do photo restoration.
It's fantastic stuff, Jeff. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks very much.
You can find my full interview with Jeff online at the Spark blog. We also have a link to his website where you can watch videos of the vocal joystick in action, cbc.ca/spark. Last time on Spark, we talked about one vision of the future of the internet, where digital information is dispersed around the real world. Well, another vision of the next web takes those online fantasy worlds, places like Second Life or games like World of Warcraft, to the next level. Now, what's one of these online virtual worlds like anyway? Well, imagine a digitally animated landscape. Okay, now you have this little cartoon version of yourself, that's the avatar, and that's in that landscape. Using your computer keyboard, you can make that avatar move around. And here's the cool thing. You see the world around you from whatever perspective your avatar is at. So if your avatar walks through a door and then turns around, you see the back of the door. Your avatar is almost like an extension of yourself. Now, my avatar is named Intention Hoisin, my Second Life avatar. Do you have an avatar?
I have an avatar that I've gone into Second Life a few times with, but actually most of my metaverse activities have been in World of Warcraft.
Oh, gamer,
there,
I see.
My avatar is named Okino Satoshi.
Jaime Cascio is a futurist, so you might expect him to hang out in virtual worlds a lot. But increasingly, businesses are setting up shop in virtual worlds. There are cultural events there. Authors give readings there, like sci-fi author William Gibson did for his new book, Spook Country.
It was strange. I had like relatively little prior Second Life experience. And it was a good way to start the tour, though, because as I said to the first Life audience I had after doing that, I said, I'm so glad that you guys aren't going to be like doing sitting back flips and flying up and buzzing around the ceiling and, you know, like that last audience I had.
Now, a lot of these virtual worlds right now are for entertainment or games, but they don't have to be.
It already turns out that there are people who use Second Life and World of Warcraft in similar environments as a way of, or as a place to meet with coworkers who aren't in the same geographic area.
Right.
We do the stock market in what we used to call cyberspace, and we look for partners in what we used to call cyberspace. And increasingly, that's the quickest, the most efficient way to look for those things in quantities.
People who look at the future of the internet say that the next step is blending those fantasy worlds with the kind of mock-ups of the real world we already have. Google Earth, for instance, is made up of satellite photos that blend seamlessly into one another, so you can zip from an image of your home to, say, downtown London in seconds. So what happens when the avatars and 3D landscapes from fantasy worlds meet the realistic images of a place like Google Earth?
We're likely to be spending hours upon hours every week there, and not feeling like we're getting away from the world, not feeling like we're isolating ourselves by going online, but in fact feeling like we're going out with our friends.
Already, if you visit London in Google Earth, there's a mock-up of the city's financial district, with 3D virtual models of buildings that you can wander through, and a timeline of the area's history. So what happens when your avatar can wander all over the web, exploring virtual versions of real places? Maybe your avatar will wander the streets of the City of London, going into a virtual stock exchange to find information on the British financial world. Web walking instead of web surfing.
Well, I don't think the boring old web we have now is going to go away. I think that these kinds of technologies operate in somewhat different, albeit overlapping, niches. You will see some of the stuff that we currently do via the web migrating over to the virtual settings. But some things like sending email actually work better in the kind of flat 2D virtual piece of paper interface that we use right now. So I would expect that the web and email will coexist very nicely with the virtual, with virtual realities.
But once you've got your avatar wandering around virtual versions of real places full of added information, will you be happy with the boring old world anymore?
Well, in some ways, it becomes a question of how do you define the real world. If you define it in terms of having meaningful interactions with other real people, then you're actually doing a much better job of keeping yourself in the real world by spending 8 hours a night playing Second Life than you are spending 8 hours a night watching television.
The thing is, these days, the next big things are coming so quickly, I'm not always sure we're ready for them yet. But keep your eyes peeled for more talk about the 3D web and the metaverse. I think we're going to be hearing lots more about it in the next 6 months.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you're listening to Spark. Tech, trends, and fresh ideas.
cbc.ca/spark.
On next week's show, the latest marketing trends. Did you ever see the movie Minority Report? Tom Cruise's character walks into a store and he's greeted by ads that know his name and his purchasing history. Well, we're not quite there yet, but a Canadian company is creating smart, reactive marketing for stores, including Walmart. So if it starts raining outside, you might see ads for umbrellas in the store. Do you think it's a helpful guide for getting the products you need? Or is it a recipe for an invasive nightmare? Let us know what you think about it at the Spark blog and listen in for the item next time.
There, miss. You see, the heterodynes are feeding back into the stimulus reaction activators, causing non-snaps of the motor control resistor units.
Well, thank you very much.
And that's perfectly all right. And if there's anything else you want to know about your robot, don't hesitate to give us a ring. Good day.
Yeah, here's something I'd like to know. Whatever happened to that handy household robot we were going to have? The one that cleaned the kitchen? Yeah, I know we have the Roomba robot vacuum, but I mean a real humanoid robot. Well, now, Corey Kidd...
My name is Corey Kidd.
...has invented a robot that will sit in your kitchen.
And talks to you every day about how much you're eating and exercising.
Yep, your very own robotic Jenny Craig sitting on your countertop.
You know, when you start it up, it will greet you, say hi, make a little small talk, and then ask you about a couple things. The first is about how much you've eaten, so what is your calorie intake? And offer some feedback specifically on what's happened in terms of either your diet or your exercise, whichever one you'd like to hear. At the end, it asks a couple of questions about how well you think you're working together, so it can try to improve and relate better to the person. And a little more small talk, say goodbye.
Corey's a PhD candidate at MIT, and for his latest experiment, he placed his army of Weight Watchers in Boston homes, just like Amna Carrero's.
My name is Amna Carrero. I used a robot in my home in order to help me lose the weight.
So first of all, what does the robot look like?
The robot is colored in white, and it looks like a lady, actually. You can tell that it's a girl. My husband and I named it Maya.
Maya.
Maya was hers.
And it has this big brown eyes.
Two big brown eyes that look out at you. And a small camera that's kind of hidden in the forehead. So what it's trying to do is make eye contact. We've seen that the ability of something to make eye contact is really one of the keys to initially engaging a person, to really drawing you into the interaction.
Those eyes that move and follow you, and she just looks so cute. What I loved about it, it would tell me, it seems that you did not reach your goal for today. I suggest that you take extra 15 minutes of walking at your lunch break.
Ah.
And then it would ask you, do you find the suggestion helpful?
Uh-huh. You know
what? It might sound somewhat odd, but even though it is a robot, you'll get a sense that it genuinely cares by the feedback that you receive.
You know, we talked to Amna Carrero, who was one of the participants in the study, and she told us things like...
When you interact with a robot, it makes you want to be good.
Yeah, it makes you want to be good. She said it's like a friend. Does that surprise you that she would have such, an emotional response to the robot?
Not at all. And it's not that people get confused and really think of this as a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you ask them to explain what's going on, they'll be happy to tell you that, you know, it's a computer, it's, you know, electronics and some plastic. they understand what it is. But at the same time, we can also develop a relationship on a different level with something like this.
Mm-hmm. So how effective is the robot compared to cases where people are just not using robots but trying to improve their weight and fitness levels?
Other studies in recent years have shown that people who try to do this using the usual way, which is a pencil and paper log, maybe a stack of papers, maybe a little booklet, after about a month, 90 to 95% of people have given up trying to keep track. We as people are just not very good at keeping track of this information. It's hard to keep up with. In fact, one of the challenges I'm having is getting people to give the robot back at the end of the study. They want to keep it.
That's the best part, I think, because I lost 9 pounds.
Wow.
You know, it's like we took some pictures and a video, and we miss it because when you have a robot, it's a big thing for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we really miss it.
If you'd like to see pictures of the food robot, visit us at the blog cbc.ca/spark. Now, the interesting thing for me in all this is why we get or don't get certain technological innovations. I mean, I guess I always assumed it's because there's a, you know, technical reason for it. But sometimes it might be a legal reason, like the patents, or maybe a hidden cultural reason, like the secret role paper plays in our lives. Or even a psychological reality, like the way we react better to a robot that seems to care about us than we do to a piece of software. We'd love to know what you think of the show and what you think of magical innovations that are always just around the corner. Drop us an email, spark@cbc.ca, or call us 416-205-8974, or visit the Spark blog to comment on the stories we air on the show, find extra audio and links to the stories we talked about. And you can also hear the entire show again and subscribe to our podcast. The blog is at www.cbc.ca/spark. I'll be there. Drop by and say hi. Spark was made this week by Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, Tom Howell, and me, Nora Young, and by
Adrian Bowyer,
Richard Harper,
Jeff Films,
Corey Kidd,
Anna Carrero,
Jermaine Casho,
William Gibson, and by
Jennifer Adamson in Toronto.
Spark was made with Creative Commons music. Find the artist at the blog. Bye for now.
And maybe you can explain why the bearing puts the transmitter which sent those calls slap in the middle of the Mare Australis.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.